destitute, to those in the doorway who might be tempted to sit in the aisle, I tell you that we will stop the meeting and throw you out. The fire marshal has made it very clear that if we do that again, we'll have to meet elsewhere. So please don't sit in the aisle. The other lecture room, number one, just along here, is wired for sound, not television, but sound. And there are a number of people there now, but there are quite a few empty chairs if you'd like to go into the next lecture room. That didn't work. It's a bit superfluous to say who our speaker is. Obviously, he's so well-known and so highly regarded that we can't provide a hall that's adequate. I'm told that there's an Owen Barfield Club at Yale, and it doesn't need any further description than that. In addition to being superfluous, any introduction must be inadequate, because if I was to do an adequate task of introducing Owen Barfield, I'd occupy the time that we want to hear him. But custom demands something. It'll be inadequate, but I will tell you this. Owen Barfield was born in London. He graduated from Oxford in 1921 in English language and literature. He was a regular contributor to the New Statesman, the London Mercury, and other literary journals. Thereafter, occasionally, to Criterion, New Criterion, New Age, 19th Century, and others. Mr. Barfield entered the profession of law in 1931 and practiced as a solicitor in London until 1959. Since then, he has been visiting professor in philosophy and religion at Drew University, in English literature at Brandeis University, in philosophy at Hamilton College, in English literature at the University of Missouri, in religious studies at the University of New York, and he has always been interested in the relation between poetry, science, and religion. His major publications include Poetic Diction, A Study in Meaning, Saving the Appearances, A Study in Idolatry, Words Apart, Worlds Apart, A Dialogue of the 1960s, An Ancestral Voice, Speaker's Meaning, What Coleridge Thought, The Rediscovery of Meaning, and I mention one other, Evolution of Consciousness. That is his subject tonight, Mr. Owen Barfield.
Ladies and gentlemen, the president's flattering remarks and the general sense I get when I look round is of great expectations. That of course rejoices me, but at the same time it arouses a feeling which perhaps can be best expressed in the colloquial phrase, I hope it's all right. I'm reminded of a couple who were touring somewhere in the Middle West of America, I think, at the time of the drought. They were both extremely fond of fruit, and they'd had a very long, hot day and had been able to get no fruit and very little to eat or drink. Arrived as the sun was setting, a small town, and saw a large streamer stretched across the street. Annual strawberry feast. All are welcome. So, of course, they rejoiced and stepped on the gas, drove up to it. When they got a little nearer, they saw there was some small print underneath which said, owing to the drought, stewed prunes will be served. Well, dismissing those unmanly apprehensions, I'd like to begin by asking the question, is there any real difference between what, but I should say first of all that the actual title of my lecture is History of Ideas, Evolution of Consciousness. And I begin by asking the question, is there any real difference between what we mean when we use the word evolution and what we mean when we use the word history? It sometimes looks as if there's not. Whether you talk about the history of the earth, or the evolution of the earth, or of mankind, makes no difference. On the other hand, the terms are not always interchangeable. No biologist would talk about the history of species, and no historian would refer to the evolution of the Peloponnesian War. This shows, I think, that there really are two different concepts involved, and that we should do well to keep them distinct in our minds, whether or no we allow them to overlap in the looseness of casual speech. Well, what then is the difference? And it seems to me that the historian J.R. Collingwood was laying his finger on it when he argued in his book, The Idea of History, that, and I quote, all history is history of thought. Maybe that in putting it in just that way, all history, he was spoiling a good case by overstating it. But whether that is so or not, he was drawing attention and drawing it usefully, I think, to the fact that when we speak of history, we have in mind, or ought to have in mind, something that imports a consciously directed process, at least in some degree, a conscious process. There may be, even in recent history, as Marxism, for instance, maintains, much in the process that is going on unconsciously. But in order to be historical, it must be, in some measure, a conscious process. And that surely is what distinguishes it from evolution. By contrast with history, evolution is an unconscious process. Another and perhaps a better way of putting it would be to say that evolution is a natural, history, a human process, since nature in its higher development does, of course, include animal consciousness. I don't, however, think we can say it includes human consciousness, not that is, unless we're happy to smudge our vocabulary. Nature, someone will say, includes human nature. Very well, but insofar as we treat man as a part of nature, for instance, in a biological survey of evolution, we are precisely not treating him as an historical being. As an historically developing being, he is set over against nature, both as a knower and as a doer. And we can no longer consider him simply as a part of nature. Unless, of course, when we use the word nature, we really mean everything, in which case the word ceases to be of much use to anyone. One of the disadvantages of being an out-and-out materialist is that you can no longer use the word nature with any consistency, because in your system it includes everything. Just as one of the disadvantages of being an out-and-out idealist is that you can no longer use the word spirit meaningfully, because in your system it includes everything. Now, when Collingwood contrasted this study of history with the science of nature as sharply as he did, he was concerned primarily with historical events. He gave us an example, Caesar crossing the Rubicon. And historical events, he said, are different from natural events inasmuch as they are always in some degree the result of, or they are accompanied by, thoughts. He went on to say that we only really experience history, and therefore we only study it properly, to the extent that we reenact, which is a word, that we reenact in our own minds the thoughts which preceded and accompanied the actions it records. As a theory of history in general, this latter contention has been disputed by historians and others, but that need not concern us now, because whether or no it is true of history as a whole, it is certainly true of one branch of history. Whether or no it is true of the history of man as doer, it is self-evidently true of the history of man as knower, or if you like, as would-be knower. You cannot study the history of thought without thinking the thoughts whose history you're studying. This particular branch of history, which I'm calling the history of man as knower, has been attracting increasing attention in the last few decades under the title of History of Ideas. What sort of discipline, then, do people usually have in mind when they speak of history of ideas and perhaps create an academic department with that label on it? Maybe something like this. Instead of wrestling head-on with, let us say, the philosophy of Aristotle and asking where he was right and where he was wrong, we trace how the ideas that constitute that philosophy arose as corrections, modifications, refutations of the earlier philosophies, the philosophy of Plato, for example, and of the pre-Socratics before him. And then we observe how those ideas were themselves corrected, modified, refuted by later thinkers. We arrive by that route at the scholastic philosophers of the Middle Ages and by the like dialectical progression onto Francis Bacon, Descartes, the English empiricists, Immanuel Kant, and so forth. Such a discipline is undoubtedly a very valuable one, provided it is conscientiously and not superficially pursued. But it is based on a certain assumption which it is my principal purpose to question. It assumes that all these philosophers were asking themselves the same questions and then finding different answers to them. That they were talking about the same things and merely reasoning differently about them. That means that the history of philosophy is treated in effect as though it were a dialogue between contemporaries. Admittedly, a somewhat one-sided dialogue, since the philosopher who participates first has no chance of replying, owing to the unfortunate fact that he's dead. But the texture, so to speak, the mode, is a mode of dialogue or dialectic. Now, of course, history of ideas is not confined to the history of philosophy, but I think you'll find this same assumption underlying the history of ideas as it is commonly approached and treated in other domains as well as philosophy, whether it be ideas in religion or politics or science. And now, to explain why I question that assumption, I must go back to the difference, and arising out of that, the relation between history and evolution. I call one of them a natural process and the other a human process, and it seems to follow from that that there is, to begin with, a simple chronological relation between the two. History is later than evolution. It only came into being after evolution had already had a long innings. The physical basis on which our thinking rests had to acquire something like its present form before there could be a dawning of what we call ideas. Let me leave aside for the moment the question whether it is also a mutually exclusive relation, whether, that is, history must also be thought of as progressively replacing evolution, or whether the two processes can continue side by side. For whatever we may think about that, the chronological relation raises another question, which I would rather consider first. When, at what stage was it in the process of evolution that thought first made its appearance and history, in its proper sense, therefore began? Obviously, we're taken back by such reflections into a long period which is sometimes loosely designated prehistory, a period when man, both as doer and as knower, must have been already active, although we have no surviving records of him. It's a period about which there has been any amount of speculation and plenty of unsupported assumptions. There is, however, one assumption which I think must be made, and that is that there is something else which made its appearance on the stage of evolution before thought could do so, and that is perception. I hope you'll allow me to use that term rather loosely, more loosely than it could be used in any closely constructed epistemological theory of perception. I mean it to cover a wide gamut, ranging from what is better called sensation at one end of the scale to what is called feeling at the other end. Because I want only to fix attention on that point in nature, whether we're speaking diachronically of evolution or synchronically of the ascending scale of organisms in the present, or again of individual growth, individual mental development, up to the beginning of self-consciousness. I only want to fix attention on that point at which nature becomes a duality, the point at which there is both an outer and an inner to be considered. Call it the point at which consciousness appears, if you like. But I have to eschew that term for the moment, because consciousness for us normally includes thinking, and the distinction between thinking and perceiving is just what I have to emphasize. It's one of those distinctions which is obvious without being sharp or clear. It is obvious and remains obvious to every normal mind, although when we come to analyze it, we may not be able to rule a boundary line. It remains obvious, this distinction between thinking and perceiving, as the distinction between day and night remains obvious, although when we begin to analyze it, we come up against such refinements as dusk and twilight. There's more than one way of characterizing the difference. Perception is essentially a passive experience, something that happens to us, thinking an active one, something that we do. Or if you don't like that, because of refinements such as the so-called intentionality, which some have detected, rightly I would say, in perception, or on the other hand, because of the passivity of that uncontrolled type of thinking called reverie, then, put it this way, thoughts are something that comes from within, perceptions something that comes from without. The point is not how we choose to characterize it, but that we all realize the distinction as a matter of course and without any real difficulty. Unless, of course, we go out of our way to lose sight of it, to lose sight of the distinction, as some philosophers have done who ought to have known better. One of the most valuable lessons I learned from Coleridge was to detect that terribly obsessive and terribly contemporary fallacy which supposes that we must only distinguish things that we are also able to divide. It is closely allied to an obsession with space as the criterion of reality. When we divide things, we set them either in fact or in imagination side by side in space. But space is not the be-all and end-all. And there are many things that, by reason of their interpenetration, I think I'll repeat that word, interpenetration, cannot be divided, though they're easily distinguished. acquaintance and friendship, for example, or say, envy and hatred. We shall see, I hope, that for human consciousness as it is today, thinking and perceiving come within that class. Let me pause for a moment before I go on to dwell on this obsessive confusion between distinguishing and dividing. I call it an obsession because I see it as one of those ingrained habits of thought of which it is difficult to say whether they are conscious or unconscious. It is that mental habit, and this is also something which Coleridge perceived so clearly, that has been both cause and effect of the whole direction taken by natural science since the scientific revolution. I mean the concentration of its attention always on smaller and smaller units, molecules, atoms, neurons, genes, hormones, etc. The concentration on these minimal units on the supposition that concentration is the only direction in which advancing knowledge can proceed. The beneficial results of such a combination of reduction and concentration for the purposes of technology and manipulation need no stressing. But again, like space itself, technology and manipulation are not the be-all and end-all, not at all events for me. In any case, their usefulness for the study of such matters as history and evolution is, to say the least of it, questionable. And my subject, as you know, is evolution and history. I will only add, before returning to it, that however impressive may be the practical justification for this atomic obsession, there is no evidential justification whatever for the conclusion, or rather the assumption to which it so often leads, namely, that the parts preceded the whole in time, the wholes in time, and that the world was actually built by putting together the units into which our mind is divided, as a house is built by putting bricks together. Interesting attempts have been made to arrive at the relation between thinking and perceiving by imagining them actually divided from each other. You may possibly remember the philosopher William James's supposition of a confrontation between, on the one hand, the environment, all that we mean by nature, and on the other, a man who possessed all the organs of perception but who had never done any thinking, and his demonstration that such a man would perceive nothing, or nothing but what James called a blooming, buzzing confusion. Well, James was only expressing in his own vivid way the conclusion which always is arrived at by all who make the same attempt, who imagine the same confrontation, whether philosophers, psychologists, neurologists, or physicists. Unfortunately, it is also a confusion which is commonly forgotten by the same philosophers, psychologists, neurologists, and physicists almost as soon as it has been arrived at, or certainly as soon as they turn their minds to other matters, such, for instance, as history or evolution. I mean the conclusion, the irrefragable consensus of opinion that what we perceive is structurally inseparable from what we think. In particular, I decline to forget that when I try to fix my attention on such matters as evolution and history and the relation between them. I refuse to forget when I'm in that room in the library what all those philosophers and neurologists and so forth taught me in the other rooms, namely that what we perceive is structurally inseparable from what we think. With what result? And here I must come for a moment, the nearest I hope I shall need to come to what is commonly disparaged under the name of metaphysics. You'll sometimes hear people say they have no metaphysics. Well, they're lying. Their metaphysics are implicit in what they take for granted about the world, only they prefer to call it common sense. And at this point in my lecture, unfortunately, I have to question rather radically what, under the present dispensation, the great majority of people do take for granted about the world. And this involves putting the question, what do we really mean when we use the expression, what we perceive? And putting it without at the same time conveniently forgetting that what we perceive is structurally inseparable from what we think. And the answer is that we can only mean the very world itself, or at all events, the macroscopic world itself. The physicists, as you know very well, have been telling us for a long time that in addition to that, or somehow underlying it, there is the microscopic and submicroscopic world that exists. And moreover, that it is only this microscopic and submicroscopic world that exists independently of ourselves. That it is only that submicroscopic world that has an objective existence, to which some philosophers have added that it is therefore only knowledge of that world that can really be called knowledge at all. Well, evolutionists and historians must think differently. The knowledge they are aiming at is knowledge of the macroscopic world. And that, as I have been emphasizing, is unquestionably both subjective and objective. When a historian, for instance, talks about Caesar crossing the Rubicon, or any man crossing any river, he does not mean by the word river simply a combination of oxygen and hydrogen. He means a rich assemblage of qualities like coldness, gurgling, flashing in the sun. When he's describing Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, the word cold does not signify a thermometer reading. It means the felt quality, cold. And when an evolutionist refers to red woods or red deer, he's not referring to vibrations or light waves, but the quality, red. All quality is subjective as well as objective, and the macroscopic world is compounded of qualities as well as quantities. It is, therefore, what we perceive, and accordingly is inseparable from what we think. I hope my vocabulary has not been irritating anyone. It doesn't matter what you call it, whether you say macroscopic or real appearance, or whether you borrow from phenomenology and speak of the world as experienced, or the monde vécu. As long as you remember that what we perceive is the actual world, and not a kind of shadow show pretending to be the actual world, with an actual world consisting of particles or mathematical equations or something of the sort hiding behind it. Well, maybe that sounds obvious enough. And if anyone feels that I've merely been laboring the obvious at inordinate length, I can only refer him to George Orwell's observation that, and I quote, "We have now sunk to a depth at which the restatement of the obvious is the first duty of intelligent man." Obvious as it is, we have to exert a real effort to remember it when we go on to realize a certain consequence it entails. It entails in particular that when we speak, as I did a little earlier, about consciousness, about the point at which consciousness arose and so forth, we're speaking not merely about human nature, as we call it, but also about nature itself. When we study consciousness historically, contrasting perhaps what men perceive and think now with what they perceived and thought at some period in the past, when we study long-term changes in consciousness, we're studying changes in the world itself and not simply changes in the human brain. We're not studying some so-called inner world divided off by a skin or a skull from a so-called outer world. We're trying to study the world itself from its inner aspect. Consciousness is not a tiny bit of the world stuck onto the rest of it. It is the inside of the whole world. Or, if we're using the term in its stricter sense, excluding therefore the subconscious mind, then, although it is not divided from the outer world, it is so... I'm sorry, then it is part of the inside of the whole world. If we're using the term in its stricter sense, excluding therefore the subconscious mind, then it's a part of the inside of the whole world. That's why, although it's not divided from the outer world, it is so very easily distinguished from it. For what can be easier than to distinguish the outside of something from its inside? To imagine the inner divided from the outer. I say with some help from Descartes, but that help should not be exaggerated. To say that what we perceive is inseparable from what we think is not the same as saying that what we perceive is dependent on any philosophy. What it is dependent on is a collectively and historically hardened habit of thought of which we are no longer conscious. Two very different matters. As any convinced idealist who has just stubbed his toe on a stone will tell you, and as Dr. Johnson failed to realize when he thought he was refuting Berkeley by kicking one. And it's precisely because of the great difference between these two that there's a difference between history of ideas on the one hand and history or evolution of consciousness on the other. It is these passive habits of thought, not any ideas we are actively entertaining at the moment, that are inseparable from our perceptions, and it is the changes in these with which a history of consciousness must deal. At this point, I think I must forestall a possible objection. While I've been emphasizing, not to say reiterating, the fact of the inseparableness of perception from thought, some of you may have long enough memories to recall that sometime before that, I had observed that in the longer perspective of human evolution as a whole, perception must have preceded thought. But if there could ever be one without the other, then they cannot after all be inseparable. Actually, I rather hope this objection has occurred to you, because it brings up at once the fundamental difficulty of studying consciousness historically at all. The difficulty is this: you cannot study anything without speaking and reading and writing about it. You cannot speak or read or write without using language, without using the language of today as your medium. But the language of today is itself the product, the manifestation of the very thing you're trying to undermine, so to speak, with your historical depiction of the way in which it came into being. You can dig into the earth with a spade in order to get beneath the surface. The spade is itself a product of the earth, but that doesn't bother you. But if by some mysterious dispensation the spade were part of the very patch of earth you were splitting up, you'd be rather nonplussed, because you would destroy the instrument by using it. And that's the sort of difficulty you're up against when it's not the earth you're digging into, but consciousness with your mind, and when it is not a spade you're digging with, but language. Some people regard the difficulty as insuperable and reject any study of consciousness itself as impossible. Ludwig Wittgenstein, for instance, insisted that there are some things you can't say anything about, and the foremost among these is saying itself. But I don't think it's quite so bad as that, and Wittgenstein, as far as I know, never tried the historical approach. In fact, however, the historical approach is all important. When William James experimented with fancying what it would be like, what perceiving would be like if it were divorced from thinking, he found it, you remember, reduced to chaos, to that blooming, buzzing confusion of his. But this, I am persuaded, was because he was imagining it happening today, and therefore when he thought or spoke of perception, he was thinking of perception as it is today. In other words, he was merely demonstrating the impossibility of separating what is now, in fact, inseparable. It's otherwise, however, if we imagine inseparableness, not as I think he was doing, in terms of a kind of molecular aggregation and interspersal, but in terms of interfusion or interpenetration. That need not mean losing sight of the distinction. The distinction between thinking and perceiving is, as I've said, fundamental and self-evident. And we can only lose sight of it by deliberately averting our eyes from it, as the philosopher Hume did, for instance, when he succeeded in persuading himself that ideas are faded sense impressions. And now, if we go ahead with studying the relation between the two in terms of a real interpenetration, what sort of results do we get? We shall find in the first place, I think, that it's not a fixed relation, this relation between thinking and perceiving, but a variable one, variable in terms of the predominance of the one component over the other. And the example of this that comes most readily to hand is the difference between poetry and prose, or perhaps that it's not external literary forms I'm thinking of, I'd better say between the poetic principle and the prosaic. But I will go on saying poetry and prose for short. If we study the uses that have been made and are still being made of language, we can hardly fail to observe that in the language of poetry in general, the perceptual element is proportionately higher than in prose. While in prose, the intellectual element predominates over the perceptual. And then if we continue the survey, we shall find, I certainly believe, and certainly many others have so found besides myself, we shall find the like variable predominance when we compare language as a whole in its earlier stages with language in its later stages, or the earlier stage of any one language with its later stages. In the early stage, the perceptual element is relatively greater. In the later stages, the intellectual element. And this, not so much in the use that is made of words, as in the meanings of the words themselves. Thus, in our historical survey of consciousness, we find ourselves looking backward down a perspective which reveals more and more of perception and less of thought. And if along this path we allow our fancy to approach the kind of consciousness that would be all perception and no thought, what do we come to? We come to something that is perhaps equally hard to imagine, but is certainly very different from William James's blooming, buzzing confusion. What sort of thing then do we come to? Can anything be said about it? Let me return for a moment to poetry and prose, or let me say now to a language of imagination on the one hand and of abstraction and analysis on the other. There is a certain element in the best poetry which critics of literature have sometimes striven to indicate and philosophers of imagination have struggled to formulate. And it's this, that in the language of imagination that is most powerful, we are made to feel a kind of union between the observer and what he is observing. Charles Lamb, for example, could speak of a level of writing at which, and I quote, the imagination seems to resolve itself into the element it contemplates. If this accords with our experience of poetry, and it certainly accords with mine, then it also says something meaningful about that supposititious condition of consciousness which would be all perception and no thought. And in saying it, we have found language itself not a hindrance, but a help. That is because it's a good deal easier to see that language arises from an interpenetration of thinking and perceiving than it is to see that consciousness itself does. So that to study a language historically, taking into account not only its analytical function, but also its poetic substance, is a good way of studying the evolution of consciousness. In doing so, we are studying that evolution from within, and therefore studying consciousness itself, not, as the biologists do, studying the evolution of something else altogether, and then, on the basis of that study, making all sorts of unwarranted assumptions about the evolution of consciousness. You will be satisfied with that way only if you are blandly convinced that consciousness is a tiny bit of the world stuck on to the rest of it. Of course, the difficulty is still there, the difficulty that made me say I was glad of the objection I envisaged. We've had to use the word perception because it's the only word we have, and we've had to go on using it about a kind of consciousness that must be so different from what we now experience as perception as to be almost unrecognizable. I believe, nevertheless, that anyone who's taken the trouble to follow me must agree that, though I may, of course, be mistaken, I've not simply been talking nonsense. The alternative of using a different word altogether also has its disadvantages. What word, and at what point do we give up using the word perception and start using that other word instead? I myself have occasionally used the word participation to try and indicate a predominantly perceptual relation between observer and observed, between man and nature, and one which is nearer to unity than to dichotomy. I fear the amount of time I've expended on this topic may have given the impression that evolution of consciousness means for me simply a lot of speculation about its origin or its very early stages. But believe me, that's not so. I have been expatiating on the evolution of perception for two reasons. First, because it gives me an opportunity to look at one of the objections, gave me an opportunity to look at one of the objections that is often raised to the whole project, that difficulty of speaking about consciousness at all. And secondly, because in doing so, I had to sketch the broad conceptual framework within which I do feel this study has to be placed if it is to bear any fruit. The study of natural history at any point is going to be pretty useless unless it's pursued within the broad conceptual framework of evolution. Not necessarily Darwinian evolution, but evolution in its essential meaning of the process whereby one form emerges from another. So I feel sure will the historical study of consciousness be pretty useless unless it is conceived of as within the longer process of evolution, evolution by detachment, emergence from identity with the inner workings of nature, through consciousness to self-consciousness. This process, this development, it may be worthwhile to observe, is the sequence presented in substance in a book published last year, which has made something of a stir in the United States, to judge by the number of people who've asked me if I've read it. I refer to Julian Jaynes's The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. The author, it is true, seeks to fit in what he has to say with the theory of a varying relation between the two halves of the brain. But the book's not really about the brain. It's a valuable and well-documented account of the development of consciousness from the earliest times down to our own. And as such, I found that it made no difference to the conviction it carried whether one accepted or ignored or rejected the intrusive bits about the brain. Well, no, that's not quite true. It was much more coherent and more convincing if one ignored them, because they are really incompatible with all the rest. But just as a book about biology or natural history, although presupposing evolution, is by no means necessarily about evolution, so a book or study about the history of consciousness, although presupposing its evolution, need not necessarily be about it. On the contrary, it may well be concerned with the art, the literature, or the science of some particular period, including, last but not least, our own period. The difference between reading such a study, such a book, and reading the general run of books on the same subject will then be something like the difference between entering a shop that sells cut flowers and selecting one or more bunches, which is a perfectly sensible thing to do, but not the only thing one can do, and entering a shop that sells growing plants in pots and selecting one or more of them. Let me try to indicate an example, and one that's especially relevant to the relation between history of ideas and history of consciousness. There's no time left in this lecture to do more than indicate. Referring to the history of ideas, I spoke near my beginning of its application to philosophy. In that domain, history of consciousness must do something more than the sort of things I described. It must take into account the fact that philosophers have, and always have had, to begin from the world they live in, that is, from what they perceive. And it will try to become aware of some of the habit of thought that is structurally inseparable from that world. As one single instance of this, when it has to consider references to the four elements, fire, air, water, and earth, in, let us say, Aristotle's Metaphysics, or his work on generation and corruption, or elsewhere, it will not be content to treat these terms as having nearly the same meaning that the corresponding words have in our own language today. It will be very much aware that the perception of these elements, common to Aristotle and his contemporaries, was much less a perception of something detached from themselves, much more a perception of qualities and processes to be found within themselves, within their own consciousness, as well as without, in nature. They did not need lectures to remind them that qualities are both objective and subjective. And the historian of consciousness will be even more aware of this when he comes on the same terms in the writings of earlier philosophers, Heraclitus, for example. And from a background such as this, he may profitably go on to other and wider issues. He may, for instance, try to review and assess the essential difference between two primary periods into which he will be inclined to divide the history of man as knower. I mean the period before the birth of philosophy and the period after it. For he will know that philosophy, and later on science, have always performed a dual role. They have operated both as effect and as cause. As effect, inasmuch as they start from and are limited by the mode of perception common at the time of their origin. As cause, inasmuch as in the further course of time, they themselves help to bring about the formation and fixation of habits of thought divergent from those that prevailed before them. And it is from these divergent habits, from this different perception as their base, that subsequent philosophers will be starting in their turn. The philosophy of Immanuel Kant
is based on a Galilean Earth and a Copernican universe. He could never have produced it if he had been born a few centuries earlier in a Ptolemaic universe and on an Aristotelian Earth. This leads back to a question I raised nearer the beginning of this lecture, but without then pursuing it. There's no doubt that history, as I have defined it, came later than evolution. Are we also to assume that it has replaced evolution? Is it, and it's almost the same question, is it simply a product? Is the world that we live in today, or at all events is different from the world that preceded it, simply a product of the scientific revolution? Some people are inclined, even apart from any especially intensive study of the history of consciousness, to take that view today. I think it's an oversimplification. There's plenty of evidence in language and elsewhere that unconscious changes in the nature of perception may continue alongside those caused by changed habits of thought arising out of the development of ideas. Changes of the latter kind, let me call the history of ideas changes, had certainly been going on already long before the scientific revolution. But Professor Butterfield, in his book Origins of Modern Science, has no doubt that changes of the former kind, evolution of consciousness changes, had been going on as well. Let me conclude by reading a brief passage from that most illuminating little book, Origins of Modern Science. Professor Butterfield writes as follows: "Through changes in the habitual use of words, certain things in the natural philosophy of Aristotle had now acquired a coarsened meaning or were actually misunderstood. It may not be easy to say why such a thing should have happened, but men unconsciously betray the fact that a certain Aristotelian thesis simply has no meaning for them any longer. They just cannot think of the stars and heavenly bodies as things without weight, even when the books tell them to do so. Francis Bacon seems unable to say anything except that it is obvious that these heavenly bodies have weight, like any other kind of matter which we meet in our experience." And then again, a little later, I quote again: "Between the idea of a stone aspiring to reach its natural place at the center of the universe and rushing more fervently as it came nearer home, and the idea of a stone accelerating its descent under the constant force of gravity, there is an intellectual transition which involves a change in men's feeling for matter." Change in men's feeling for matter, in other words, a change in their reality principle, a change in their common sense, and it's the successive changes in men's reality principle, in reality itself, in the common sense by which men live, that history of consciousness tries to find its field of study. I should perhaps just say in conclusion, you may have noticed that in spite of the pointed antithesis in the title of this lecture, I mean, history of ideas, of evolution of consciousness, I have been referring in the course of it sometimes to the evolution and sometimes to the history of consciousness. This was not because I regard them as merely synonymous, but because I feel that the two processes, the one unconscious and the other deliberate, do continue side by side. Reflections of that nature can lead into far-reaching questions. What is the nature of the forces that are determining our evolution in addition to those that we rightly classify as historical? I raise this question now at the very end without attempting even to begin to answer it. I will only add that in my opinion, the true answer is much more likely to be found by investigating the evolution of consciousness and its relation to the history both of ideas and of consciousness itself than in any exclusively biological theory extrapolated into the past from the natural science of the present, however popular and habitual such a theory may have become.
Mr. Barfield has agreed to accept questions. There are a number of persons in the other theater, theater number one, and if they wish to ask questions, I would ask that they go to the microphone, stopping on the way at the red telephone that I pointed out, arranging for sound, and I'll take the second question from the other room by calling on you there. The first question from this room, but may I ask you, please, as I have before, to make it short, because it will be necessary to repeat the question so that it can be heard in the other room, and therefore they will be able to follow the proceedings. I think you've scared me.
Huh? Yeah.
You've scared me. Is there anyone in the theater number one who would like to ask a question? You've scared them too. The question is, will you please define perception?
The answer is no.
You can't perceive of it. Well, can you do better? Is there another question?
There are a couple of people with questions over in the other room. Do you want me to try the sound treatment?
See if it will work.
I want to be clear. If consciousness was all perception and no thought, in what way would it be different from William James that will be studying confusion?
What I was...
Would you repeat the question for the other group? I can't.
Yes. I think the question was, correct me if I'm wrong, if consciousness was at one time all perception and no thought, how would it differ from William James's blooming, buzzing confusion? That's right, isn't it? Well, that was really what I was trying to make clear throughout the whole of the lecture, I suppose. And I was suggesting that it's very difficult for us to imagine, to realize, but that we can be helped towards it if we take examples from the kind of consciousness of today, where there is a higher proportion of perception to thinking, and the example I gave was poetry.
Right.
William James was assuming that this he had in his mind this picture of consciousness as being a detached piece of the world, so to speak, and that detached piece being confronted with the rest of it. But and that would no doubt be the case if his experiment could be carried out in our time, but My suggestion was that all the evidence from particularly a study of language suggests that an earlier form of consciousness in which perception did highly predominate and was perhaps at one time exclusively perceptual and not mental would not have been like that, but would have been more in the nature of the presence in the human mind of the forces of nature, forms and forces and patterns of nature, actually constituting their consciousness. It was more like a union with the world than this exclusion plus blooming buzz and confusion. But really, my whole lecture was trying, and I can well believe not altogether successfully, to answer the very question you've put.
The next question is coming from the other room. We'll have to answer. Would you go ahead? I'm sorry, it didn't work. I'm sorry, in the other room, we hear nothing here, so we'll carry on. This gentleman.
May I pose three questions among which you might give your choice?
Oh, goodness. No. Who else has a question? Yeah, take one.
The electronics won't work. I'll bring the questions.
Good. Yes. Good.
Could you explain what you meant by the history of man as Noah?
I didn't work with the Scots here in OWER.
As a Noah. Yeah, that's what I
mean. So does it mean this?
The questioner...
Well, the period before man as a Noah and afterwards. I didn't really understand what you were saying.
Well, the question is as to man as a knower and before he was a knower. Would you use this so they can hear us back home?
Yes.
I suppose the distinction between knowing and doing is clear to you, isn't it? I mean, there is the external history of wars and rebellions, geographical discoveries, and so forth. Events, history of events in general, that was what I meant to cover by the history of man as doer. And there's the history of ideas, which is the history of the kind of thought human beings have here, which is history of man as knower. Isn't that very clear? I wonder for the moment whether you thought I was spelling Noah, N-O-A-H, but you weren't.
Thank you. This gentleman, who had three, can now ask one. I'm sorry, you were interrupted, I apologize.
You say that poetry is primarily concerned with perception, thought. It's more distant from perception. There's a distinction between the object and the subject, or in that case, your notion here seems to be pretty much like that of the naive and sentimental of the early romantic period.
Do you mean... Sorry, I'm finished.
He asked if there was any comment to make on... I won't try and repeat it. I'm sorry, in the other room, I'll ask Mr. Barfield, in answering it, to pose it.
Well, have I got it right? You said that in the remarks I made about poetry and prose,
I seem to be referring to the naive and sentimental type of poetry, or romantic poetry. Is that roughly?
I didn't state it well. I have two ideas. One is that your notion of the development of consciousness is pretty much like the notions of the early Romantic period concerning the passage from the naive.
Oh, I see.
And I'll leave it at that. Would you have a comment?
Now, if I could try to repeat that question, it wasn't quite a question, really. It suggested that the way in which I presented the transition, is that right, from an earlier type of consciousness, which was more perceptual, less intellectual, but more perceptual, to our own, was pretty much the way some of the Romantics have presented it. You could think of Romantic philosophers, perhaps, rather than Romantic poets, was pretty much the way some of the Romantic philosophers have presented it in their writings. Yes, I think it is. I think it is, yes. And I don't know whether... many of them, or any of them, have quite connected it with the development of language in the way that I was trying to do. Yeah, possibly Humboldt did, but I'm not so deeply read in the German philosophers that I should like to carry the answer any further than that, but in general I agree.
I'm going to invite you to ask the next question, because you can come up here and ask it. Please?
Could I just sit here?
Yes, you can just sit there, but I thought that way the others could hear you.
How would
the other
idea of consciousness relate, for instance, to the philosophy of Schopenhauer, the will to live?
How would the
I am, therefore, I think. Is there any relation at all between consciousness as you expressed it, or is it closer to the idea, the history of ideas, rather than a consciousness?
Sorry, I haven't quite got that improved.
Would you say that again?
Yes.
Shorter.
What I mean is there any relationship at all between consciousness, perception, idea, thought,
and will?
Yes, where does will fit into this gamut?
The question is, where does will fit into the relationship of consciousness, ideas, and thought? Is that correct? Anything to say?
Well, get into rather deep waters, really. I suppose I would say that we can't really conceive of the will of a human being except as being the will of an individual, and that the existence of individuality in human beings is something which evolved in that process of evolution by detachment, from nature, which I indicated especially at the end, I think, so that there would be an increasing element of will, what we understand by will, as time goes on, certainly, yes. You You asked rather casually, rather loosely, how it fits in. That's it, the only sort of answer I can give, I think, which is also rather loose and casual, I'm afraid.
There's one behind you. Speak up.
Okay. Would you care to comment on a possible connection between the state of completely perceptual awareness, that kind of awareness which you might have seen at the beginning of consciousness? In other words, that kind of consciousness that preceded consciousness, or that kind of awareness that preceded consciousness. Perception preceding history. Could you comment on a connection between that kind of awareness and the state of consciousness that might adequately be represented by the statement that unmarried man is a bachelor?
I haven't got that afraid, but unmarried man.
Can you have another way for stating the alternative?
You're familiar with, of course you're familiar with the distinction between a synthetic
statement
and an analytical statement.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of people.
Okay.
Get to it.
You better
say it quickly and short.
Okay. You're familiar with the distinction between a synthetic and analytical statement.
I think so, yes.
Okay. I had to say that one.
30%.
given the possibility of there being a state of consciousness that could be represented by an analytical statement, for example, that unmarried man is a bachelor, a particular perceptual...
I'm sorry, I haven't got the unmarried man again. Could you...
That unmarried man is... Oh, pardon me, that married man is a bachelor.
The married men are bachelors.
Yes, right. Oh, pardon me, that unmarried man is a bachelor, yes. I'm all over the place here. Okay.
Yes.
What's your question? In one sentence.
In one sense?
In one sentence.
Given that there's an analytic state of consciousness, do you see any connection between that and a perceptual state of consciousness?
Okay.
Maybe you take another book to ask.
Get your terms clear. I don't really know what you mean by analytic state of consciousness.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to explain.
I think we'd better find a shorter one.
Yeah.
One more. Time is gone. Very well.
Mr. James' book on the origin of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind, I think it's the hypothesis that primitive man hallucinations, they heard voices similar to those described by Joan of Arc. Do you agree with that? Do you think that this is how...
Well, I don't know. I think Jaynes impounded in the word hallucination a complete antinomy in his whole presentation, because he kept on saying that experiences like that of the muses at the Greek table were not subjective. He says, not subjective.
Yes, that's right.
Therefore, they were objective, and therefore they were part of nature and not merely a part of consciousness. On the other hand, he keeps using the word hallucination. I can't conceive of an hallucination which is not subjective, but apparently he can. And that's why I say that his whole conception of the cause of the process being the two halves of the brain is incompatible with the rest, because he is doing what William James did, really. He's assuming a world of a perception without thinking, so to speak, but also in terms of a mind, a contemporary mind, which has a contemporary kind of brain. Well, I won't go into detail, but anyhow, that
That is what.
They perceive me.
I'm not sure I'm a married man or a bachelor now.
I think we better.
Well, that is the answer, really. I mean, I think he uses the word hallucination in a way which is quite unjustifiable and really unmeaningful.
There's been a hand up here from the beginning, and this is the last question, I'm sorry.
If we can assume that, say, that the tragic view of the world as a development of consciousness...
The tragic view is what?
The tragic view of nature, the tragic view of life, yeah, as a development in consciousness in some way. Can we assume that some people who presuppose this, if they presuppose that it's the subject of a history of consciousness, whereas if they consciously form a series of events into tragic form, then we're dealing with
a
history of ideas. Am I
understanding
the kind of distinction you're trying to make?
I'm afraid I haven't quite got it.
Okay, well,
are you asking me whether...
Sophocles, for example, suggests that Aeschylus didn't know what he was doing when he made these tragedies, whereas I, Sophocles, am very clever. I know exactly what I'm doing. If we're talking about the development we see in Aeschylus, yes, we're saying this is a history of consciousness, whereas when we're looking at Sophocles, we're talking about the history of ideas. I'm trying to get...
I would think the transition from Aeschylus to Sophocles is related to that division between the two primary periods I referred to at the end, period before the birth of philosophy and a period after, and I would have thought that Sophocles comes into the second half, really, when the conscious operations of the my thought, in fact, is beginning to alter consciousness and not to be altered by it, not merely to arise from it, would be. And figure from it.
That's a fine distinction.
Yes, it's a very fine
distinction. I think all things, good things, must come to an end. I'll ask Professor Gold, if he would, to thank the speaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been very privileged to have as our speaker tonight a man whose depth of scholarship in so many fields is so demonstrably profound. Mr. Barfield, we're very grateful that you've made this journey here to Vancouver, and I think perhaps the best and most sincere vote of thanks that I can propose is that we assure you of an equally warm and attentive audience on your next visit to British Columbia. Thank you very much.